Paying for college is one of the largest financial commitments you'll ever make. It's also one of the most emotional. Ron Lieber wants to help show a path around these very personal landmines. Ron Lieber is a personal finance columnist who has written for the Wall Street Journal and since 2008 has been writing about money for the New York Times. He writes the Your Money column for the Times. His new book is called The Price You Pay for College, an entirely new roadmap for the biggest financial decision your family will ever make. I spoke with Ron Lieber about the project.
I think the biggest reason I decided to write the book was that my inbox was increasingly filling up each April with sad stories from families, parents who are otherwise extremely sophisticated and smart and successful in their chosen fields, who just felt like they had been run over by a steam locomotive when their first or only kid went through the college application process. And the thing that they had missed was that the pricing and the discounting systems for these colleges had changed utterly in a generation and that nobody was talking about it.
Well, one of the questions I have written down here is the average American family financially savvy enough to navigate the maze of programs they need to go through?
You know, I don't think this is rocket science exactly. And you know, for better or for worse, we Americans have been trained for complexity in our navigation through the economy, right? Buying a car is not straightforward. Purchasing a cell phone plan is not straightforward. Things that should be simple are not. And we're sort of used to complexity. Now this is a sort of higher order of complexity, and it's compounded by the fact that it's not just a bigger dollar amount, but it's probably the most emotional purchase decision you'll ever make because it involves your offspring or the kids that you've adopted and their future and trying to, you know, establish some kind of, you know, exit trajectory for them from your household. And you really want to do it right.
Is this an industry where people think, well, the more money I spend, the better the kid is going to be?
Well, first of all, my compliments to you for describing it as an industry, because one of the mind flips I'm trying to get people to engage in is to think about this as a consumer decision, right? That you are an actor in a marketplace that's competitive, and you have the right, and I would argue sort of obligation to yourself and your family, to ask a bunch of very pointed questions about what's going on here.
So let's take the average college or university classroom anywhere USA. Look around the room. Is every student paying the same price?
Not at all. I mean, you know, it's probably not all that similar to, you know, whatever the last Delta flight was that you took through Atlanta, right?
Okay.
You know, if you asked 30 people on the plane, you probably would find 30 or 40 different prices. And depending on the institution, you know, there's some percentage of people who are paying full price, right? So, you know, if you go to the University of Florida, to the you know, flagship campus in Gainesville, there are plenty of people there paying full price because they haven't qualified for any discounts. But there's basically two tracks of discounting that goes on now. There is the need-based track, which depends on how much your family earns and how much your family has. And then there's what's become known as the merit aid track. Now, you know, in many Southern state schools, you know, residents there are sort of used to the idea that your grades and your test scores may earn you some kind of a discount. This is not a new thing at the state universities. But what is new is the sort of competitive weaponry that's being wielded by all sorts of private colleges, but also some publics too. The University of Alabama in particular has been a pioneer here, but the University of South Carolina is doing the same thing. And basically what they're trying to do is throw money at kids from out of state to make them feel good about themselves, to make them feel meritorious, hence the name merit aid, so that they might be willing to spend a little bit more to go out of state because they feel like they have been patted on the head. And when somebody from, you know, a faraway land is all up in your kid's inbox telling them how great they are, it is easy for you as a parent to begin to think that you've done something really right here. And there must be some reason why these out-of-state schools are throwing money at your kid. And you know, maybe it would make sense to spend an extra five or $10,000 a year to send the kid out of state. And then all of a sudden you've got sort of scrambled brain syndrome and you're acting on emotion and not on the basis of pure reason. And so, many of these discounts really are a kind of head trip. And part of what I'm trying to do in the book is just explain to people how this works so they can approach this with the clear head that the decision and the situation warrants.
Well, you do mention this in the book, and I'll ask the question, how much of this is driven by guilt?
I think guilt is one of the biggest emotional factors that are involved here. And I mean, let's break it down into its sort of component parts, right? I mean, to take a step back, right? We always have to remind ourselves that, anytime a large amount of money is involved with a purchase, that purchase is going to draw on any number of emotions or feelings that may or may not be helpful. In this instance, we've really got to be careful because, we're making decisions with and on behalf of our children. There is no more emotional decision that, anybody makes in their life than this one. So we start there. Money equals feelings. Certainly fear is part of the mix here. Fear that if we do it wrong, our kids will go tumbling down the social class ladder. There may be snobbery, right? Not sending my kid to community college. We don't like those people in Alabama. We certainly don't like their football team. So, why would I send my kid there? some of that goes on. But guilt, I think guilt may be one of the trickiest ones. Why? Well, think back to a generation ago when we went to college. We were able to work our way through in many instances, and that may not be the case for our kids now. Or maybe our parents stepped up and they were able to take care of the entire thing. But now, right, even if your kid is going to a state university, full freight there, the retail price, if they don't qualify for any discounts, that might be $80,000, $90,000, $100,000, $110,000 or more if they don't get out in 4 years. And you just may not be able to do that, right? And if you can't, well, you're subject to or vulnerable to guilt. Guilt that you're not making enough. Guilt that you didn't save enough. Guilt that you haven't taken a second job. Guilt that your parents did it for you and you can't do it for your kid. Guilt that may be coming from a parent or parents who are still alive and are questioning your judgment and your spending in a way that makes you feel badly. Maybe the kid is making you feel guilty because the kid doesn't really understand the context, doesn't understand what all these big numbers add up to. One of the things I'm trying to help people with is just to kind of get off this guilt trip that people send themselves on, because the system really is different than it was a generation ago. And you've almost certainly done the best that you could to get your kid, ready for this moment where they could be eligible for these schools. And, just stop beating yourself up.
Something that you mentioned and we talk about a lot here on the show is community college. And, the old plan, go there for 2 years, transfer to a 4-year school. In the book, you say that's a great plan, but it doesn't really happen that often, does it?
Well, look, the national statistics say this, right, that people who start community college, it's only, a teen percentage of them that actually get to the 4-year institution and finish the whole thing in under 6 years. That is not a great statistic. But, if you were to ask the people who start at community college with the absolute dead-on intention of, getting through a 4-year school in 4 to 6 years, it'd probably be a higher percentage, but here's what people don't understand. You just have to be incredibly type A about the whole thing if you want to get it done in 4 or even 5 years. You need to know exactly what your intended destination is on the very first day of community college. You need to know what your intended major is. You need to know exactly what classes you're going to need to take at the community college and how they will transfer over. You want an advisor at the community college. You want an advisor at the intended destination. Hopefully those advisors are speaking to one another. And 3 times a term, at the beginning, in the middle. And then at the end, when you're registering for next time, you want to be checking in with both those people to make sure nothing has changed and that you're not doing it wrong. And then you've got to be first in line for registration. And if you're working your way through or working to, you know, help pay your rent, then you've got to rearrange your work schedule around whenever these classes are that are absolutely necessary. So, you know, none of this is easy, right? I'm already kind of out of breath trying to just sort of spit it all out. It can absolutely be done, but you've got to be, you know, organized and careful, or else it'll take, you know, 5 or 6 or 7 years, and then you sort of miss the point of the savings.
But if done correctly, you will save, won't you?
Absolutely. Look, there are all sorts of people who get this done in 4 years, right? They literally sleep at the foot of the bed of the advisors at the community college who have these so-called articulation agreements that committed to memory, right? The articulation agreement is what are the sort of rules and regulations that govern which credits can transfer to what schools and under what circumstances. And if you find that person, that advisor, you know, on both ends, and make those people your best friend and do everything that they tell you and just commit yourself to it full time, if you're able to, if you don't have to work, you can absolutely get this done and, you know, get a great 4-year degree, you know, for under $50,000, right? If your parents don't charge you rent for the first couple of years while you're living at home and doing community college.
Still to come, our conversation with Ron Lieber continues with a look at the changes the pandemic has caused this process, if any. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett, and our guest today is Ron Lieber, the New York Times Your Money columnist and author of the new book, The Price You Pay for College, an entirely new roadmap for the biggest financial decision your family will ever make. I asked if, like everything else in life, COVID-19 has changed this whole thing.
You know, I thought it might. This book was supposed to come out in August of 2020, and we hit the pause button because we just didn't know what was going to happen. And here's what ended up happening that was super curious, right? You know, everybody was sent home in March of 2020. A lot of upset people, a lot of people wanting not just room and board refunds, but tuition refunds. But then August, September rolls around of 2020, and all of these undergraduates come flocking back to school to the extent that schools were willing to have them. And a whole bunch of them got sick, right? So, you know, against all reason, everybody comes running back. And to me, that was clarifying, right? Because a couple of the biggest reasons to go to school, you know, the education and the kinship, right? Finding your people, finding your friends, finding your mentors, that was all stripped away. People weren't learning all that much in these Zoom rooms last spring, and they certainly weren't getting to spend quality time with their friends and their mentors. So people were willing to come back, and they were willing to come back and pay exactly what they paid the year before, even though the experience this fall has been extremely compromised, right? So what does that tell us? Well, I think what it tells us is that we now see the residential undergraduate education that, you know, so many people in the middle class and above chase. We see that as a sort of rite of passage. And I don't think people are clamoring to blow it up. I don't think the experience of being in Zoom rooms in the spring led a bunch of people to believe, oh, yeah, we could and should do this at, you know, 35% of the cost and just keep everybody in their teenage bedrooms. That is not what the market wants.
One other thing that might have changed from when you started writing this is we have a new administration in Washington, and there has been talk of some college debt forgiveness. How does this change mindsets going on, if it actually does happen?
Well, I guess I would encourage people to think about it this way. Just because you know, some kind of forgiveness or cancellation, depending on which term you use, even the terms have been politicized now. If some of this debt gets wiped away by the Biden administration or by Congress, what does it mean for the future? I mean, there's concern that it becomes a sort of moral hazard, that if you do it once, that, you know, people will expect it to happen again someday and they'll borrow more than they might have. I trust American consumers, you know, a little bit more than that. You know, if this happens at all, it's meant to be a sort of form of stimulus, but maybe also an apology for the fact that, you know, we've been using teenagers as guinea pigs in this crazy national experiment now, which has led to $1.7 trillion with a T dollars in student loan debt, albeit not just from undergraduates. And so whether it's a stimulus or whether it's an apology, I don't think people are going to think that it's going to happen on the regular. So I don't know if that'll change the calculus for all that many families, because the fact of the matter is that, you know, even if we wipe away all the student loan debt, we're still going to be stuck with the same system that we have. And that system is unaffordable enough that $100 billion new dollars of student loan debt gets accrued each and every year. So, you know, in a decade and a half, we'll be right back where we were, even if we wipe away all of it.
Is the small town liberal arts independent college a thing of the past? Can they survive?
Those schools can survive, but my guess is that not all of them will. There are a number of small liberal arts colleges, you know, particularly in the Midwest and in the Great Plains, that are hurting, that are struggling. And, you know, a handful of them go out of business each year. And, you know, it might be a large handful or a couple handfuls that, you know, meet their maker in the next couple of years just because of the pressures that have come, you know, from the economic situation in the wake of the virus. But all sorts of these schools are capable of and in fact deliver on, you know, a fabulous education each and every year. And there are administrators there, and, you know, I traveled and visited some of them, who are keenly aware of the fact that consumers and the marketplace are demanding a more thorough accounting of what is happening to undergraduates while they are there, and how well they're being prepared for the labor market, and, you know, and anyone else who may be a, you know, consumer of their product, you know, anyone else who may want to hire or admit their 22-year-old graduates. And so, you know, they are doing their best to prove their worth. And, you know, there have been a couple books the last couple of years just about small liberal arts colleges and why there is a sort of pivot in the labor marketplace in particular, and realizing that the graduates, the alumni from these institutions are in fact versatile, competent, you know, fluid, and good employees. So, you know, this whole notion that the liberal arts experience is kind of going out of style, I think is overstated.
Well, finally, you've got a parent or you've got an entire family looking at this big mountain of debt that they're just about to start climbing. Why don't they just say, you know what, the heck with it, go get a job?
Well, the best economic data that we have suggests that if you don't go to college, the difference in lifetime earnings between, you know, somebody who does and somebody who doesn't, all things being equal, is going to be roughly $1 million over a lifetime. So that's a lot of money. But, you know, at what price happiness or lack thereof? I am not here to pass judgment on anyone who waits to go to college, doesn't go to college at all, decides to pursue a trade. You know, it's becoming increasingly evident that, you know, we're going to face a shortage of, you know, plumbers, electricians, carpenters. There are all sorts of trades where you can make a perfectly respectable living or better than that, you know, if you hustle. And, you know, I've got no problem with parents and teenagers who choose that route. I just want people to have their eyes wide open about, you know, what the data looks like, you know, for any given industry that that they're chasing. Just to be crystal clear about what college would be for them, right? What they would be attempting to pursue and what the alternatives might lead to, both in terms of their finances and also in terms of their happiness and satisfaction.
Again, the name of Ron Lieber's new book is The Price You Pay for College, an entirely new roadmap for the biggest financial decision your family will ever make. Health and safety precautions during the pandemic have led the Air Force to eliminate parts of basic training. But some military observers question whether the changes are leaving airmen unprepared for duty. From the American Homefront Project, Carson Frame reports.
Some elements of basic military training at Lackland Air Force Base are the same as they've always been. Think pre-dawn workouts, obstacle courses, silent meals in the chow hall, and screaming instructors. But as the pandemic tightened its hold on the country, the Air Force made adjustments. Basic training was shortened by a week, and things like marching, hand-to-hand combat, casualty care, and survival skills were cut back. Tech Sergeant Alexandra Springman is a military training instructor.
So we always say flexibility is the key to air power, and that's really been a true statement. We have definitely had to adjust.
Trainees normally do chemical and biological weapons training, where they expose themselves to tear gas and practice putting on protective equipment. But now that's off limits because the gas masks can't be properly cleaned between uses. And because of social distancing, trainees have to use dummies to practice applying tourniquets and bandages, something they used to do with one another.
That does not provide even close to that real-world application. So while it's pretty easy to apply a tourniquet on a dummy, you can't know if you're actually putting the tourniquet on tight enough and cutting off that circulation, cutting off that blood supply.
Though Springman and other military training instructors understand the need to keep airmen safe, they still wish they could teach them more.
We do feel kind of robbed in the sense of we're not being able to complete all those additional training objectives that enhance training, because sometimes those are the things that the trainees remember.
But with new health and safety guidelines coming down all the time, both trainees and instructors have had to roll with the punches. Would-be linguist Zachary Maples finished basic military training in November.
With all of these things, you just got to go in with the attitude of, I'm not here to know exactly what's going to be happening. I'm here to be trained. And just having that mindset kind of kept the stress of change kind of to a minimum.
Air Force leaders say the upheaval in basic training won't affect readiness. Colonel Rocky Wilson commands the 37th Training Wing at Lackland. He says basic training is supposed to work as an orientation to the military, not a final lesson. He says there will be more opportunities down the road, like during an airman's vocational training or before a combat deployment.
They get all that when they get to their home station anyway, especially if they're going to deploy into a contingency.
But critics argue that curtailing basic training is a problem. Mark Kansian is a senior advisor with the Center for Strategic and International Studies, a bipartisan think tank in Washington, D.C. He says traditional military skills help teach airmen about hardship and teamwork and what it really means to be in the Air Force. Without enough of that, they might not be mentally prepared for what's next.
The kinds of things that they've had to cut out, you know, these are the military skills, the warrior skills that let people know that they are now in a very different kind of environment. And it makes it a little harder for someone arriving at a unit to accept the sacrifices that might be entailed in service in the field.
He adds that it's difficult for advanced training and operational units to get airmen caught up on basic skills, especially since there are already so many other demands on their time. Back at Lackland, Colonel Rocky Wilson says they're taking the opportunity to teach recruits more about the Air Force's history and values. And the pandemic has been a valuable lesson in and of itself.
This has been a wonderful readiness training, and it's not an exercise, it's real. And so if we can beat COVID, then we can beat any competitor around the world, we know that.
But he says his top priority is controlling infections and protecting trainees, even at the expense of some traditional skills. I'm Carson Frame in San Antonio.
Right here on The Old Show, we've talked a lot about how students are reacting to at-home learning during the pandemic. But how are their parents holding up? That's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Parents have been substituting as teachers during the pandemic. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Aixa Marchand, assistant professor of psychology and educational studies, documents the challenges of this for essential workers and others.
Because the COVID-19 pandemic has forced many students to learn from home this year, schools and teachers are relying on parents now more than ever to be their partners and co-teachers.
And while the switch to virtual and hybrid learning models in K-12 schools has been confusing and tiring for educators and families everywhere, it has been especially difficult for parents who are essential workers, for those who have lost income due to the pandemic, and for families who don't have access to the resources necessary for virtual learning. In a survey taken earlier in the pandemic of families in the Smoky City and Klondike areas, two historically Black neighborhoods in Memphis, 67% of respondents reported that they had lost jobs or income due to COVID-19. Many of those who are still employed are essential workers and are unable to stay home and assist their children with virtual schooling. In a separate survey of families in Shelby County Schools, the public school district here in Memphis, about 17% of respondents reported that they don't have the devices and technology necessary for virtual learning, and about 13% said they don't have access to reliable Wi-Fi. Better internet access and technology isn't the only thing families need to be successful during this difficult time and unusual school year. But for many who lack these resources or the ability to dedicate their full attention to schoolwork, the switch to virtual and hybrid learning is exacerbating existing racial and wealth gaps. Students without reliable internet access and appropriate devices will remain stagnant, while their peers who are able to log into school virtually will continue to make academic progress. These circumstances, which have highlighted the importance of parents as valued partners and co-teachers, have also underscored the barriers so many of them face when it comes to involvement and engagement in their child's education.
That was Aixa Marchand of Rhodes College. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. While you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org, and you can find us on Twitter at TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at WAMC.org.